This episode is brought to you by Dreammakers, an amazing organization that comes alongside youth who have aged out of the foster care system by connecting them to our resources so they can navigate their life with help and support and tangible gifts. Dreammakersproject.org. Thanks to our sponsor, Seminary Now. Seminary Now is an amazing online streaming platform where you can get video resources to help you grow in your faith, from deep theological studies to lessons in social justice and spiritual integration. SeminaryNow.com/cuss and put in cuss30 for a discount for MLA listeners.
You're listening to Managing Leadership Anxiety, Yours and Theirs, a podcast offered in partnership with Missio Alliance. Each episode, we discuss internal and relational pressures, how they block effective leadership, and how we can move through them to a greater health. And now your host, Steve Cuss.
Friends, let's get right to it. My guest today is Brad Lominick. I've been a big fan of Brad's for a long time now. You probably know him as the president and executive director of Catalyst, where he served for about a dozen years. The Catalyst Conference and the Catalyst Network becoming, in many ways for many church leaders, the go-to resource so that they can be well and inspired and equipped. Catalyst describes Brad himself very well. I think that's the kind of leader he is. And in many ways, Brad's my favorite kind of leader because he's the kind of guy that's brilliant in a lot of areas, but unpretentious, highly relational, and he absolutely loves equipping and empowering other people to succeed. Brad's got his hand in a lot of pies nowadays, does a lot of consulting for churches and organizations. He's the author of The H3 Leader. I'll put a link in the show notes. I'm always intrigued by when a leader can first identify how young they were when they first realized that they had leadership gifts. That's where our conversation began when I asked Brad, how old were you or what was going on when you first figured out you had some of these skills? Let's take a listen.
I think it was either kindergarten or first grade. Let's just say first grade.
Okay.
And first day of class, Mrs. Weaver's class, small town in Oklahoma. And I remember being so intentional about learning everybody's names in the class. And by day two, I was connecting some of the other classmates to each other. I was trade deals in the cafeteria. I was finding ways to, you know, to get my commission out of it or whatever that looks like. You know, hey, you've got some Doritos over there and you've got a, you know, a cinnamon roll. Let's do an exchange here. And nobody told me that, Steve. Like nobody, my parents or family members didn't say, hey, when you go to first grade, this is how you get ahead. It was DNA, deep God wiring in me. And it didn't equate to leadership at that point, but this idea that I could be the one that set the tone with the atmosphere, with the environment of the class, with being able to connect to not just other students, but other teachers. I mean, I remember even in first grade, we had a first grade building and there was three classrooms and I wanted to go like get to know the other two classes and the teachers of those classes. And there was just this natural wiring in me to be connected to all the people who were sort of in the mix. And that was the first sign for me, first expression of that wiring. I mean, I would say tactically, when you start school sports or any kind of sport, whether it was soccer, especially early in elementary school, fourth or fifth grade playing football, American football, which is the best football by far. That idea that you're the captain or you're the player who's going to set the tone, who's going to hold other players accountable, who's going to lead by example. So, yeah, early in life, man, it was very apparent for me.
That's fascinating. So when you're in first grade and when you're like leading a football team in those elementary years, it feels to me like there's a difference between it's just you doing your thing, Like you're going around and meeting teachers, and it's quite funny to picture it, Brad. I can almost picture you running the PTA, you know, and as a first grader. But then as you get older, you become more self-aware and you can kind of see yourself rather than it's just what you do. You start to see yourself as I'm a kind of person who does these things. Do you remember that shift for yourself?
It's a great question. I don't necessarily remember when that reality started to set in. I do remember in some ways, the uncomfortability that, wait a second, am I the brown noser? Uh-huh. Like, am I the teacher's pet? Am I the person who is trying to get ahead by manipulating? And that fine line between, no, I really do want to know all these folks. I want to be able to connect dots and see patterns and build connections. And compared to, I really just want to get an A on my test. And the best way to get an A on that test or in the class is that you start to become, again, you start to show up and be the student that you think the teacher wants. And that was really, I think, wise, discerning, I think insightful, probably ahead of my time in terms of just knowing, oh, I don't want to be that other side of that. So let me make sure that I'm really intentional about, especially other students, you know, because the thing about school is that there is no holds barred in terms of the way your fellow classmates see you. When we get into adult life, everybody holds back and they won't tell you, and they're talking about you, but they won't say it to your face. And man, elementary school, middle school, kids don't hold back. It's like, hey, you're the brown noser, right? Like, just trying to get ahead. So I was really sensitive to that. I think part of that too was that, and even the football connection. You know, my dad was a football coach. And so the connection to that sport obviously made sense in terms of, you know, an environment, an atmosphere where you felt like you could actually demonstrate skill, know-how, talent, but also leadership. And, you know, I've heard like other coaches' sons or sons of like NFL players, you know, Peyton Manning, or Eli Manning, as an example. You know, they talk about their father raised them, obviously, around football. And so people will ask them, well, were you automatically drawn to be a quarterback, to be a leader, to be actually just a football player? And, you know, they're just the fact that they were around it automatically connected them to it. And so for, I think some of that, you know, going back to your question, when do you know you're a leader? I think a lot of that is well, what environments are you put into? Where did you actually start to show up based on even what your family environment was and where they automatically just sort of dropped you off and said, go get them, figure it out, right? So that's, I think that's a big part of, for me, my own journey, but also seeing that in people now today, like when you start unpacking all that stuff and you go, oh, well, obviously because your mother was in the banking industry, and you showed up after school 3 days a week at the bank and you got to hang out with the tellers. Well, obviously that made sense that you wanted to be an accountant when you got older, and then you ended up being a bank president and now you run one of the biggest banks in the world. So the family dynamics plays a huge part, in, of course, in, you know, the way we are raised and what environments we get put into.
Yeah, you're talking about two themes here, I think, Brad. You're talking about, the environment, but you're also talking about this intuitive ability, not chameleon, but to figure out what the other person wants. As I was listening to you in that early part of the question you're addressing, what it kind of jumped in my mind. I wonder if Brad is perfectly designed to thrive in prison. Has anyone ever told you that?
No, first time ever.
Yeah. Well, congratulations to me. But as I heard you, like you talked about middle school and elementary school, these people are brutal. They're unfiltered. You have to figure out what they want and give it to them. I immediately thought, Brad could probably do quite well for yourself doing hard times.
Well, and I mean, listen, man, think about the realities of friendship in elementary and middle school.
Yeah.
And I think, Steve, for me, it was I don't know if it was a gift. I don't know if it was a learned behavior. I do think it's DNA, though.
Yeah.
Being able to have emotional intelligence, to be able to build relational equity with people, to understand and see patterns, to have empathy, and to know, okay, this person feels like they're giving me a certain vibe. Therefore, you know, the way I interact with them probably needs to be customized differently compared to the way I act around this other person. And that's so much a part of the learned behavior of just how you operate around people. And, you know, I'm actually concerned that we're not giving kids or students or even young adults the outlets to be able to learn that. Hmm. And you know, you keep up with this kind of stuff. So do I. Like the average company now, when they take a 23-year-old who's one of the top students in America at Ivy League schools, they bring them into their company. They're having to coach them on how to have a conversation, how to look at somebody in the eye, how to send an email that, you know, has in emotional intelligence. It's all these things that we think should be basic. And there's a little bit of a lost art of that, I think, in our culture. And I don't know why. Like, I don't know where we went wrong on that. But for me, it's always been part of the way I operate.
Hmm. Well, one of the themes I wanted to explore with you is I'm always fascinated when a leader is thrown into the deep end early in their life. I'm going to say, Brad, early in their leadership life. So for me, it was probably most infamously as a hospital chaplain. I'm 24 years of age, no previous experience, and within an hour, I'm in an intensive care waiting lounge by myself. I'm in the deep end. I got to figure it out. In many ways, I think it's those experiences that make or break a leader. What would be a time in your life where you were over your head, had to figure it out? What were you doing there?
I think every career season I've had, different season of vocation in my career, I've been in that seat. I've been in that place where I looked around and thought, I don't know how I got here, but I don't know what I'm doing. I mean, you and I were talking about Lost Valley before we officially started. And I've told this story, you know, on many outlets, and I've written about it. But Lost Valley is a guest ranch in Colorado. And I was 22, maybe 21, just turned 22, and had worked there a couple of summers in college, and then went back and became the head wrangler, which I had no business being a head wrangler based on skill set, experience, know-how, you know, 150 horses, and out in the middle of the national forest, an hour from the closest town, an hour and a half from the vet. So just on the horse, taking care of horses side, yeah, I was totally out of my element. I mean, I literally was reading, you know, Veterinary Skills for Dummies, or whatever the equivalent of that book was back in, you know, 1993 or four. And plus I hadn't led at that level. I mean, I hadn't had a job where there was that level of accountability or stewardship or responsibility. And man, it was heavy. And I will say this, because it was heavy, this was a dysfunction of my own personal leadership. I chose, and I feel like at that point, I was a pretty good, I was pretty good with people, and I was good with the guests. I was good with, you know, being able to create an experience for people who were paying a lot of money to come to this place. And I figured out the technical side of running, you know, a corral, running, being in some ways a foreman of a guest ranch with horses and cattle operation and all that stuff. What I neglected incorrectly was investing in the 12 people on my team that was probably the thing I should have been doing the most and been focused on the most, because all of the head wranglers before me, I'd seen that. Right. I mean, I had noticed that, I had been a part of that and experienced it, but I chose probably just based on, man, this is so intense, and I feel so much pressure that I'm gonna leave that one on the side. And it was not the best season for me of expressing what leadership looks like.
It's fascinating to dig into your early years in elementary school, your natural intuition. You know, you and I have this in common. I was telling you before we hit record that I lived in a ranch in Montana where kids would come up, if they got in trouble, they'd come up for a while. And the head wrangler got pregnant within my first couple of months of being there. And so I became the head wrangler. I think I'd done maybe 5 trail rides in my life by then. And we didn't have nearly the number of horses Lost Valley did, but what we had in common is these were workhorses. We rounded up cattle with these horses, and we had guest groups come in. So people do mission trips to this place, and they'd spend a week with us. I'd take them on a trail ride. You talk about your skill early of intuitively knowing the personality of the person in front of you. That translates 100% to horse personalities. I was not aware that 23 horses do not get along with each other, and I had to figure out exactly who to put on where, and I can't imagine the 100, 150. But I also hear that story, Brad, and I think, man, at 22 years of age, we just don't have the capacity and the scope, right? And we're more ego at that young age, and so, of course, you're just trying to keep up and keep guests happy. That's pretty remarkable.
Yeah. Well, you bring up something even about the horses, the ability to see a pattern and to be able to read people, you know, in essence, in about a minute, 30 yeah. seconds to a minute.
Yeah.
And to say, you know, what kind of skills do you have? Have you ridden in, how much have you ridden? And you're trying to get a sense of their personality and the way they're wired as a, you know, these are guests, and then match them to a corresponding horse that will create a great experience for them for 7 days sometimes of being there and paying lots of money. So that, you know, that became an acquired skill set, I think, to be able to read people really quick. And you kind of knew, like, oh, if this is a 15-year-old teenage girl who probably has some horseback riding experience, then and they're a bit more aggressive, they want to, you know, they want to have something that's a little harder to handle and they can manage it, you knew the horse, right, that fit that category. But finding that out from a guest when you first meet them is way easier with the guests who returned, because they had been there before. So you knew what they liked, but new guests, it was really hard. But yeah, it was, I still look back and go, I'm just so grateful that I didn't like tear up the place, or like literally, like, you know, the place didn't shut down because of me being such a knucklehead and not really knowing what I was doing. But you know, in those situations, you figure it out, you improvise, you study, you learn. But for me, looking back again, you could ask a lot of people who worked for me. I was really good at what I did, but I wasn't always like the best at investing in them. And I just missed that. I missed that window during that season.
So I do think one dynamic that builds a leader is throwing them in the deep end. I think another dynamic, Brad, that I think most leaders I respect have in common is at some point in their leadership journey, they've been burned by the organization they love. Either they worked for a church and the church burned them, or and they somehow were able to turn that burning into being forged rather than bitterness. Do you have a story like that? I'm not looking for any specific names, but do you have an example of that in your life?
Not necessarily personally. I mean, I think there's been seasons where I probably would look back and want an organization or a team or an ownership group or an executive team or a leader to have made some different decisions. I don't feel like I have one of those that represents probably the level to which you're making the case for. 'Cause I agree, like it always, unfortunately, even more in the ministry space, tends to be too much of an example. You know, I have lots of friends who have navigated this, and you know, that the idea that I always go back to this, and I don't know where I learned this, but I've tried to always have this perspective is, and it, again, it's what I would have wanted from the 19-year-old who was on my crew at Lost Valley to look at me as a 22-year-old or 23-year-old running things and to say to me or think about me, which is, hey, I realize you're only a few steps ahead of me. And in some ways, I'm probably ahead of you. And you don't really know what you're doing. You're winging it. So I'm going to give you lots of grace as a leader. I'm actually going to help you lead me. I'm going to do my best to lead up and believe the best and all the things that go with that in order then to have a posture that says, I'm for you. And you know, that is, it sounds so simple, but it's such a massive shift on the dial for so many people who I think are navigating bitterness, or they're navigating that I never got a shot, or this organization hurt me, whatever the case is. And those are legit, but at the same time, having empathy for that leader who was navigating that season of trying to lead you, and then realizing they might have just been doing the best they could. And, you know, this is that for me was an immaturity early in my career, Steve, because I mean, I looked at everybody and thought, well, it's your fault. It's your fault that I didn't, you know, get to this level or whatever the situation is compared to, no, they were trying their best. And I try to encourage a lot of leaders to just, again, take on that posture, because otherwise you're navigating so much pain and frustration, and you're allowing that, you know, that leader to have power over you, or that organization to have power over you. What do you think? I mean, you're the expert in this world, man. Like I'm playing in your sandbox right now.
Question. When I have people on, I'm always managing my own brain. And so you're triggering my memories. I was at Central Christian Church in Las Vegas when Gene Apple left. He'd had a long, faithful run and a phenomenal ministry. And he left for Willow Creek. And then Judd Wilhite came in, and Judd and I were the same age. And you could almost, this is a generalization, but you could almost divide the staff down the middle of those who said, look, he's this amazing young guy who's never led a church before, and he's going to need some time to figure it out. And what I'll say about Judd is he didn't pretend. He wasn't pretending that he was this expert. He came in with real humility and curiosity. And Judd's for anyone who knows him, Judd's a genius. And then there were others that were expecting him, you know, to be some form of Gene, where they had a very clear idea of what to do. And I think, as I'm listening to you, Brad, it's such good advice you're giving us, because I think I was in both camps with Judd and Central. When I was well, I was like, this guy's a really amazing human being. And when I was not well, I was looking to be petty and self-righteous and bitter. But when I stepped away to lead a church, that was a huge shock to me, to go from an associate pastor role to the lead role. It felt like a canyon-sized gap. And I think that's when I started to realize, holy smokes, most of us have no idea the pressure that other people carry. I think I was having my own kind of transference going on as you were sharing. It's really a good word.
Yeah. I was just with some leaders, and one of them was Ashley Woolridge from CCV in Phoenix.
Yeah. I know his predecessor, Don Wilson, well.
Yeah. We were talking about that transition and the pressure of not only like filling somebody else's shoes, but also what you just said, that Ashley was saying, as the executive pastor working for Don, he never realized how much pressure, how much intensity there was with that seat until he got into it. And as soon as he got into it, I think he looked around and went, oh, now I understand.
It's crazy.
Right?
I stepped down.
And
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, that's my point. Like we don't know until sometimes we sit in the seat of the level of pressure intensity that somebody else is feeling.
Yeah, and I think it is uniquely that top job in whatever organization. I think in church, you know, we just take church so personally, but when I stepped down from full-time lead pastoring January of 2022, and now I do this work full-time, I still attend the church where I was the lead pastor. So I went from lead pastor to a part-time pastor where I now work for our new lead pastor, who's an incredible, incredible guy. But when we had that public exchange and the elders, we had a ceremony of handoff, I told the elders, I said, all I want is for you to get up on stage. I'll be sitting down on the front row. I just need you to look me in the eye and tell me, Steve, you're not responsible anymore. That's all I need. And they were very kind to do it. And okay, great. Now Zach is responsible. And I get to help and support and encourage. And it really is true, whether it's real or perceived, boy, that burden, that spiritual burden is really something.
I've had, you know, in every season, Steve, I've had, I think, again, the gap between leading well, leading your staff and team and the people closest to you well, and then leading the movement, the organization, whatever, well, and being seen as, oh, I bet he's a great leader. And then you get inside and they're like, we love following him because he gets stuff done. He takes us to the pinnacle. But if we're honest, like, he's kind of a jerk sometimes. And that's always been, not, I guess it's kryptonite, I don't know. But it's a natural tendency, I think, for a lot of us. But it's for me, like my anxiety, like my level of insecurity, my dysfunction has always moved that direction. And fortunately, you know, I mean, I've had people that were willing to tell me, or at least I think I became self-aware enough to know, you know, that's a tendency now, so I can try to navigate it. But everybody gets squeezed in some way. The weight is going to push you down in some form or fashion and then it's going to cause you to do stuff. And we have to be so aware of that, because otherwise we're navigating like all those feelings and things, and we don't even know what it is sometimes.
Yeah, that's right. Especially if we are, I mean, now we really are in my sandbox, especially if we are driven, type A, vision-oriented leaders, we're often the last to know when we're not well. Brad, you led Catalyst for a long season, and in many ways it was really at its zenith under your leadership. When you were leading those big events and the entire Catalyst movement and the Catalyst One Days, what, in your opinion, was Catalyst at its best? What was it best at, and what just made you look back and you think, man, I'm so glad we did it that way?
Well, I think we gave permission for especially younger leaders to push the envelope and to be innovative, to think differently, you know, to look at things with a different lens. But also, I think we gave a sense of, I want to be careful how I say this, but I think we gave a sense of identity to a whole generation, you know, that was sort of looking for somebody to coalesce and galvanize, you know, hundreds of thousands, I don't know, millions of leaders, especially in America, who were looking for a tribe, you know, like looking for a sense of belonging. And not that they didn't have that, but, you know, there was also just that, I think there's always that drive and inner motivation to, you know, to show up somewhere and look around and go, okay, these are my people. Hmm. This is my crew that I'm going to run with for the next 20 or 30 years. The other thing is I would say, we created in some ways, I think, a new space for you know, people who love Jesus, who are committed to the local church, who have a worldview that is incredibly biblical, to be open and okay learning from even people outside the church, whether it was Business Voices or people who weren't Christian, or innovators, different thinkers. And that wasn't necessarily new, but it just hadn't been done much. And I think the idea that we could be equally committed to our craft while also equally committed to becoming great leaders. And, I would never, I would always honor John Maxwell, because we all worked for John in the early days, and John was really the one that gave us permission to do this. And he also gave us permission to do something different, because what was true about Catalyst was that it was taking what John had built and it was creating a different expression of it for a whole new generation. And John was the first person to tell us, hey, listen, this is my organization and you all work for me and this is Enjoy. But I understand that it doesn't have to be about me. And that was such a freeing thing to have a leader who was willing to let us create something that had a different personality to it. And John was, practically he was like, hey, if you want me to speak at it, great, but I don't have to. I don't need to be the voice. I don't need to be the one that is always there. I don't need to be the draw. And it was such a healthy modeling and example. Because even when I got to the place where I was, longer in my tenure there, it just started to sort of feel like, hey, it's time to, felt God nudging. It's probably time to move out of the way. It's time to try some new things. There had already been this intrinsic core value put into Catalyst that, hey, it's not about you, Brad. Like, it's not about one personality. It's not about, this thing's bigger than you. And you're just here to steward it for a little bit. But the part of the way we built this thing is it's meant to be run by and dreamed about by the leaders who we were trying to attract, which was young leaders. And you know how those things are. Like, we see a lot of movements that are supposed to be next gen, but yet everybody sitting around the table is in their 60s and 70s. And I wasn't that old. I mean, I was 40 when I started to sort of look around and go, yeah, it's probably time to do something different here, because the next wave needs to sit at the table.
And, movements can't do all things, but when you think about Catalyst, what was missing or what was a gap that you think either could have been done or somebody should be doing that Catalyst wasn't addressing?
Well, I think we were really good at content. We were really good at creating an experience. We're really good at practical leadership. We were not good at community. I mean, we built a movement. We built a group of people who felt connected to something. But in terms of actually taking it down to the next level and really being doubling down and tripling down on really trying to build community and create connection. Even the practical side of this might be, we didn't really have a subscription thing. We didn't really do a lot of curriculum. We were more about creating these mountaintop experiences. And I think we probably missed on that in terms of just not spending more energy on that. The other thing is, I think we did really well is we modeled partnership. We modeled unity in the church and just in the Christian space. We had everybody from every side of the spectrum that would partner with us. And that was all really intentional on our part because we wanted it to be a big tent. When I look back, I would say there was probably some things we could have done to be a bit more intentional around unity, especially as it relates to where we sit today. Meaning that 10 years ago, I think we could have probably done some things that might have kept us from the last 6 or 7 years of everybody going to their corner And I just, you know, and in some ways, like that's even for me, like if I was still been have leading Catalyst in the last 6 or 7 years, the last 10 years, I think I probably personally would have just spent a lot more time and been a bit more bullish on, listen, I'm going to leverage my influence and I'm going to get everybody together from both sides of the camp. And I don't care if it's political. I don't care if it's theological. I don't care if it's national. I don't care if it's ethnic, but I'm going to leverage my influence and I'm going to make y'all sit in a room and fight or whatever you need to do to, because what happens when we do that is they, you know, I can still disagree with somebody, but if I know them, if I'm friends with them, I'm probably not going to say terrible things about them publicly. And anyway, that's a whole nother podcast episode for another day. But I think there's a real need. There's a real gap right now, especially in the American church and just Christians in general, for somebody to help galvanize that negotiation table, the unity table.
Yeah. Yeah, that hurts what you're saying. I think you're exactly right. And man, the post-COVID conversation is just extremely anxious.
It really is. And nobody's, you know, no, I don't think anybody like sat around 10 years ago and said, hey, let's see how divisive we can get.
No.
I don't think anybody's strategy was that. We've ended up there. Now, I would say it is a scheme of the evil one. I mean, it is a strategy that to divide us and to get us mad and to like make us not talk to each other and to, you know, to call people out and all that is, and it just hurts our reputation. It hurts our ability to have a seat at the table in the public square. People look at us who aren't believers and they go, "What are y'all doing? Like, why are y'all fighting about this stuff?"
Yeah, we don't believe our own message. That's probably the biggest indictment that the watching world says.
And the reason I say all that, Steve, because some people may be hearing that and going, well, why, Lominick, do you think you have the right to do that? Well, because we did it. I mean, I watched speakers sit in a green room at Catalyst events who wouldn't even like talk to each other. And the only reason they would show up to one of our environments was because they were speaking at it. And then all of a sudden they meet that person that they've been being mean to online and they talk to him for 30 minutes and they go, wait, I kind of like that. I kind of like them. So we created that because of our ethos and our heartbeat. And so anyway, that's maybe I'm prophetically speaking it into existence that I need to first grade this thing again, man.
Right. I was just thinking, the reason you can say it is you've been doing it your whole life. You're uniquely qualified. Folks, I went to seminary in the 1990s, and in many ways, it formed and changed my life in ways that I'm still benefiting from today. One of the most powerful things for me was the way it helped me navigate scripture and make sense of it and get meaning out of it, but also the way it massively expanded my worldview. It's like it gave me more tools in my faith tool belt. What's amazing now in the 2000s, in the 21st century, is you don't have to go to seminary. There's an online streaming platform called Seminary Now, and some of those scholars that I read in books are now available to you and I in these amazing video courses. You can go to seminarynow.com/cuss and put in CUSS30 for a special Managing Leadership Anxiety discount. You've had so many relationships with so many public Christian leaders, people that we would know their names. They've written books, they're famous preachers. And that means that there are many people you know who have incredible integrity and are serving faithfully in the public square. And then you've probably known more than your fair share out of all of us of people whose private life has been exposed. And I'm particularly interested, Brad, in the people whose private life has been exposed who then double down as their attempted solution. Their next move is to deny or minimize or blame a victim or something. I'd love to just get your take. I mean, it's obviously a very open question, but your take on why are some leaders doing that? What are you seeing? What's your reaction when you get the news?
Man, I don't know. Well, first of all, I love the question. I mean, again, this is, I feel like you're Michael Jordan asking me how to shoot a three-pointer. Cause you, this is your wheelhouse. But I would say this, so first thing is, for me personally, a few years ago, you know, because of multiple friends who I think probably were examples of what you're talking about, I tried to commit to, if God prompts, I will pursue. Meaning that if I get a sense that the Spirit is telling me that I need to reach out to somebody or say something that might be challenging or to make things uncomfortable, I need to be the friend who's willing to do that. Even if it means that the friendship might be damaged or even dissolved. So that was just something I wanted to, I was frustrated because it was like, why is this happening? And am I part of the problem? Meaning that it's on me because I wasn't actually like leaning in and pursuing people and, hey, you know, there's something going on and I can tell something's weird. So I think practically that's just something that I would encourage everybody to do is, you know, how do we keep people out of the ditch? Hmm. I think we keep them out of the ditch by like making sure they stay on the road. And sometimes staying on the road means that we have to put the friendship up on the altar and say, I'm willing to sacrifice this if it means that nobody else in your world is going to get in your grill. To your question though, of, you know, why is it happening and what's going on? I don't know. I mean, I think a lot of it is that we just find out more today than we ever have, meaning that you're going to get found out. I mean, if you're, let's just be honest, like if you're trying to live some sort of hidden life, it's really difficult to be hidden anymore. Yeah. So that's one thing in terms of why we're seeing it so much in regards to what's the cause, what's there or why do people when they get involved in it, but then they still deny it? Cause I've had several of those. I don't know. I mean, I don't have a good answer for you. And I've thought a lot about this. I know this. I'm always going to look at it in terms of what's my responsibility. So what's my responsibility as a leader to make sure I don't end up there? And then what's my responsibility if there are friends of mine who end up there? And, you know, do I, especially if they've gone through something, I've tried to like be a friend that was, you know, willing to like confront, they're not willing to listen. Now they've been, you know, now they've been found out. They still won't talk to me or they just keep living like nothing happened. I don't know. I mean, part of me looks at it and goes, well, I should I just move on? Should I just put my energy into people that will, you know, actually want some feedback? So it's a great question. I don't know if I have a good answer for you.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a complex dynamic for sure. Before we get to the gauntlet, which I know you've probably been losing sleep over. What are you hopeful about? What are you excited about when you look at the local church nowadays?
Next generation stuff for sure. You know, I think this is always true, but I think more than ever, there is a new wave that is thinking differently, approaching all areas differently and not willing to fake it. You know, and some of that's because there's just less room to fake it anymore. I think they're, you know, they're the story of the church is remarkably incorrectly told, especially in places like America or other places in the world. But, you know, if we just think about, are there 100 churches in America that you know, the average person may not know about, but they are really like expressing what a New Testament church should look like, and they're impacting their community, they're serving people, they're evangelistic, they're raising up disciples, they're generous with their resources. Yes. And I don't like all the negative and all the we're at a really dire place. I'm just not sure I believe that. And part of it is because the church is the hope of the world, and you know, the church will advance. I mean, this is good news. This is hopeful, but it's expectation. So, we may just need a new marketing director. Right? I mean, we don't have a really good track record. And part of that's because everybody's looking for the clicks, you know, and clicks are all based on failure. They're all based on dysfunction. They're not based on health. Nobody really clicks on that article about, you know, the church you don't know about that's really healthy. That's not going to drive like the podcast downloads. So I'm really hopeful. And, you know, especially Steve, related to the leaders. I mean, I do a lot of gatherings very privately, very, very quietly, very under the radar with young leaders. And I've got thousands of them that I know. And a lot of them are pastors. And again, if I'm a venture capitalist doing due diligence on where to invest my dollars with my, you know, $1 billion venture capital fund, I'm doubling down on young pastors that are 28, 32, 34 that I'd believe in. And, you know, so that for me gives me optimism, probably more than I've, at least as much as I've had in all of my lifetime.
Well, Brad, you know, you've been putting it off. You've, in your history, you've wrangled horses. You've probably gazed Andy Stanley in the eyes. You may have even been held by Craig Groeschel, but you have never endured the managing leadership anxiety gauntlet of questions.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. So let's
see. Gazing in Andy Stanley's eyes is definitely a picture not worth putting on anybody's mantle.
We'll just let it fester. We'll let that idea fester as we navigate the gauntlet. I've got 5 questions for you. Here's the first one. What's something that you think you need in the moment that you don't actually need? Like for me, I would need people to always be courteous, but actually I can thrive when people are discourteous to each other. But in the moment, I just always need everyone to be courteous. What would be a need that you have in the moment that you don't actually need?
Oh my gosh. Well, control is an issue. So I travel a lot. I think you probably travel some too. I travel a lot, and I need the boarding system with Delta Airlines to be more functional and more operationally minded and more efficient. In the same way that I need the Chipotle line to be equally as efficient it drives, like I get so mad when, you know, we've got 17 people in line and we've got one person like starting the burrito and there's four people at the cash register waiting to check me out. Like, people, this is not that hard to shift some folks over here to the start of the burrito situation. So that's where my mind goes.
Excellent. Perfectly answered. Okay. How do you know, Brad, when you're not well, emotionally well, when you're triggered and full of reactivity? How do you know that?
Well, it goes back to the burrito line and the standing in the Delta trip. I think little things that should not, there's an ineffective response or an unparalleled response to a situation, especially related to anger or frustration. Okay. The classic case would be, you know, the small little things that drivers do, or, you know, so that's always a sign for me.
Okay.
Is knowing that, man, this is not a good spot.
Okay, great. Question number three, in the absence of information, people connect the dots in the most pathological way possible. That's what Jeannie Duck taught us. What goes through your mind when you're anxious about a person or a situation, but you don't have all the info?
Well, the first thing I think is, let me figure it out. Again, which goes back to control. So can I be in charge and have enough agency to resolve the situation? I don't really care about, in that situation, I don't care about the other person or the other people. I just, if I can be in control, have agency over it, then that's where my mind goes.
Okay, good.
I know you're now. I can just see it. You're reading my mail here.
We invite everyone to be exactly human sized on this show. That's the challenge. Is relaxing into human size. I will just say, since you're reading my face here, humans have up to 5 core false needs, which is control. That's the one you've been hitting. Perfection.
Yeah.
Having the answer, being there for people when they're hurting, and approval. And these happen to be the 5 core traits of God's character. So theologically, when we're wanting these things, we're just trying to be God. But hey, I wouldn't worry about it.
Wow.
Okay. So let's shift the corner and talk about God a little bit. This one's a fill in the blank. No rush on this. What if I were at least as blank to myself as God is? So for me, it would be kind. What if I was at least kind to myself as God is? What would be the blank for you?
Probably graceful.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. And then the final question is, when in your life lately, there's no wrong answer to this. When in your life lately have you felt most fully and completely loved?
Wow. Probably a year and a half ago. Maybe around that. I think that's the right timing. 50th birthday party. Yeah. Lots of texts, lots of, you know, affirmation. Yeah. That'd probably be it.
Folks, my guest is Brad Lominick. Brad is the author of a couple of books, H3 Leader. I mean, it's getting on for 10 years old now, that book, and it's still an absolute classic in the field. Brad is probably most known for leading Catalyst, And what I've picked up through this interview, which has been to my great delight, is Brad is a catalyst. That's his gift. He makes things better, he gets things going, and he does it because he has this incredible intuition, as we learned from his earliest memories, of unlocking people, figuring out what they need him to be. Brad, this has been a delight for me. Thank you so much for joining me on Managing Leadership Anxiety.
I loved it, man. Thanks for having me. And I feel like I got a masterclass in what you do. So appreciate your work and the way you're helping so many leaders, because, man, we need people like you in our corner to help us not just figure out why we do stuff, but then once we know why we do stuff, actually to do stuff in a different way that is better.
For more resources, visit stevecusswords.com or missioalliance.org.